Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on January 18th, 2020. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion introduces this year's Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So today is yet another auspicious day at Cross River Meditation Center. We're going to start our what's become an annual practice, usually over the winter. In fact, I think it's always been over the winter, sometimes over the holidays, is our 12-week study of my book, The Truth of Happiness. And I was talking to Tim. The Truth of Happiness was the first book on Buddhism that I published, but it was meant to actually be the second book. The first book was intended to be Becoming Buddha, Becoming Awakened. And this book, The Truth of Happiness, was meant as a study guide to the larger volume, but the circumstances were such. I was asked to put a course together kind of quickly for Hunterdon Medical Center. And so I just published this first. It was just, actually, this was in a pamphlet first, just so I could use it in that setting. And then I decided to publish it first. But anyway, it is... Well, first, have everybody done your reading homework?
Yes, sir.
Really? Online? Have you folks done your reading homework?
Yes. Good. Yes.
Marcin, I know you haven't had a chance to. The book is out there, and it's also online. Each chapter is online, too, linked on the website. And so you're just really, last week we read the preface, the introduction, and the first chapter on jhana meditation. And I'm going to read most of that anyway. But if you want to continue with this, I'll give the instructions. We'll just read the second chapter this week. But you won't feel left out, I don't think. If you have any questions or you're just confused, raise your hand or talk to me after class. But, so I'm not going to read the entire preface, introduction, and first chapter because we'd be here until tomorrow. But I am going to read the important parts of it. And then the way I want this to work is I want to hear the results of your homework, what you learned from this, how you see what you've read this past week, how it fits into the your larger understanding of the Buddha's Dhamma. But the preface and introduction are important. And so you understand why I wrote what I wrote. I assume, even though we should never do that, that people who have no understanding of what the Buddha taught or Buddhism at all will read this, so it's very basic. But also people that have been involved in modern Buddhism, like I was, and are confused and maybe frustrated with what they've been practicing, the book is meant to address the things that the fabricated notions that have become modern Buddhism that the Buddha never taught. It's important to address those for two reasons. One is, so I wish somebody explained to me why I was so confused. It wasn't until I read what the Buddha actually taught that I understood the nature of my confusion. So I'm hoping that this book can overcome that step. And then there's a lot of pop phrases that are thrown around today, usually related to karma or so-called positive thinking, that are attributed to the Buddha that the Buddha never said. And so the people have that influence. So it's meant to cut through a lot of the fabricated notions of what Buddhism is, and just point us all into what the Buddha actually taught. And I think it does a pretty good job of doing that. Most people would agree. Not everyone, though. This is from the preface. And we just covered the Simsapa Sutta a few weeks ago, a handful of leaves. But this describes what the Buddha taught, why he taught it in such a perfect and straightforward way. In the Simsapa Sutta, the Buddha describes the purpose of his teachings. The Buddha's words, and what have I taught? I teach the nature of dukkha, or stress. I teach the origination of dukkha, which is craving and clinging. I teach that cessation of dukkha is possible. That third noble truth is so important, because if it wasn't a noble truth, if cessation of stress of dukkha wasn't possible, we're just wasting our times, aren't we? But it's also a profound teaching on impermanence. Even a mind that is clinging to fabricated views, shouldn't even say it that way, because a mind clinging to fabricated views is really clinging to nothing. But even a mind clinging to fabricated views can change that mind. That's the whole purpose of the Buddha's Dhamma. And that's what he's describing here. And then the Buddha says, I teach that the Eightfold Path is the path leading to cessation of dukkha, this is what I have taught. And it's not just this sutta. This Buddha says that in many, many suttas, and it's implied in every single sutta the Buddha teaches. When you read these words, it's hard to understand, unless you understand the nature of ignorance, it's hard to understand how modern Buddhism became so confused and so off topic. But it's the nature of ignorance to continue its own ignorance by creating very powerful and subtle strategies that distract it away from what an awakened human being actually taught. The Buddha continues. And why have I taught these things? Because they are connected with the goal. They relate to the rudiments of the mindful life. These teachings develop disenchantment and dispassion. That's the whole point of the Dhamma, to become disenchanted and dispassionate with continued eye-making. These teachings develop cessation of stress and unhappiness. They bring calm and direct knowledge. Another important line, calm and direct knowledge. Why is the Buddha making that point? Because he spent 6 years studying fabricated knowledge and abstract knowledge, knowledge that ultimately is not useful to a living, breathing human being. Because there's nothing in the abstract that can be helpful in a directly experienced Dhamma. Everything the Buddha taught is to be directly experienced. We verify the effectiveness of the Dhamma teachings by our own experience. And the Buddha reiterates that over and over again. He implores us not to take anything on faith because he knows that that's an abstract. And he knows that that's a distraction when we cling to abstract and fabricated views. They bring calm and direct knowledge. These teachings develop self-awakening and unbinding. Unbinding from what? Fabricated views. Unbinding from ignorance. This is why I have taught them. Therefore, again, anybody confused about what Dhamma practice is about, all you got to do is read what the Buddha said. Therefore, your practice is contemplating and understanding, in quotes, this is stress. This is the origination of stress. This is the cessation of stress. Your practice is contemplating and understanding. This is the path of practice leading to the cessation of stress. And what the Buddha is describing here makes up the bulk of what we talk about, is applying this and recognizing the arising and the passing away of stress in our own lives at the point of contact. That's why we need a well-concentrated mind and the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path to understand and recognize fabricated abstract ideas that are arising in this moment, and also introduce what we understand about the Eightfold Path as a frame of reference to what's occurring. My words. The Dhamma is often presented today as an impossible goal that will take limitless eons to achieve. I remember hearing that over and over and over again. Enthusiastic about the possibility of awakening and being completely disheartened every time some so-called learned teacher said, this is the practice, but guess what? You can't achieve it ever. It's cruel, isn't it? And it completely contradicts almost every teaching the Buddha ever gave, because you can hear it and feel it in most of the suttas. The Buddha's encouragement to all human beings to take to this right now, because right now you can awaken. There's nothing that I can think of is more cruel to tell people, listen to what I have to say, but it's of no benefit to you, because that's basically what that is. The Buddha never said anything like that. My words again. This notion simply creates more confusion and develops a state of mind that is constantly grasping. And you can think about that. It's a pretty good scheme to get people to keep coming, isn't it? Come here, I'll make you feel good. But the end result is so far in the future. It's awful. And we have a direct experience, each and every one of us. Maybe Marcin might be a week from now. To actually understand that this is what's occurring. My words again. I came to see that much of the rest of this is my words. I'll mention when it's the Buddha's words. I came to see that much of my confusion was arising from the individual and culturally influenced adaptations and accommodations to the Buddha's original teachings. In other words, the many years that I was practicing Buddhism, I wasn't practicing what the Buddha actually taught. And so my confusion and frustration should be expected. If I'm trying to study something that an awakened human being actually taught, but I'm not being presented that, anybody would get confused and frustrated. When I put aside the more esoteric, magical, and mystical teachings that developed after the Buddha's death and began to study the Buddha's direct teachings, these simple and profound teachings became understandable and useful. And that's what we teach here. Buddhism adapted to various cultures within the framework of each culture's beliefs and held views. I believe the difficulty that many Westerners have had in integrating the Dhamma is in attempting to develop an understanding of the Dhamma from the perspective of an unfamiliar culture. Does everybody understand what I just said? And so the Buddha in his lifetime presented this pure Dhamma the only way that he could, the Dhamma that he understood, that worked for him and that he saw work for others. And even during his lifetime, there were strong influences to adapt and accommodate and embellish his Dhamma by people seeking recognition and power. And then after the Buddha's death, there's records of different groups now trying to take control of the original Sangha and adapting it in different ways. My article on the Pali Canon explains that, how that occurred and how it was continued. So after the Buddha's death, and this is now we're 300 or 400 years now into the future, where Buddhism really started leaving northern India and southern Nepal. And it first went north up to Tibet and then back down into China and then from China to Japan. And then at the same time, it was migrating through southern India into Sri Lanka and the areas like South Vietnam. So it wasn't one progression, but you can track the cultural influence through each country and that it passed through. And then you look at what is so-called modern Buddhism, and you see the culture has taken preference and precedent to what the Buddha actually taught. In other words, Buddhism became a way of cultural preservation rather than a true Dhamma practice. And that's true almost everywhere it's spread, but most significantly we can see today in Tibet. Because the big problem that China, and I'm not saying that the Chinese are right. I'm going to get some nasty letters. The major problem that the Chinese government has with Tibetan Buddhism is the fact that it's Tibetan Buddhism that maintains the Tibetan culture that the Chinese don't want anything to do with. Everybody needs to be assimilated into the big government. If you go into China, and I've talked to Matt, knows a lot about this. I've never been to China, but I've talked to many people. There's Buddhist temples and Catholic temples and Muslim temples. They're all, although the Chinese are getting pretty tough on Muslims. Religion isn't wide open in China, but there's Buddhism and, like I said, there's Christianity all through China, and there's Buddhist temples. So it's not that they're oppressing Buddhism as much as they're concerned about the Tibetan culture, but that just speaks to this notion that cultures have changed Buddhism way beyond anything that the Buddha intended. In fact, he didn't intend any change to his Dhamma. But it's also understandable, isn't it, that we'll adapt and accommodate anything to fit our own fabricated views. As Buddhism moved to the West with a much more pragmatic view of the world, many Westerners attempted to integrate the teachings and the cultural influences, and that's where the difficulty arose. We started acting like we're Tibetans or Chinese or Japanese or South, whatever it might be. We made believe in the culture to support our Dhamma practice rather than using the Dhamma itself. In other words, the outward appearance, the culturally influenced outward appearance, became much more important to Dhamma practice than the actual Dhamma itself. And this is felt throughout. You know, I took my vows in a certain Tibetan lineage. I spent many Sundays in a Zen practice. And throughout that, the form, the outward appearance of how you're carrying yourself is much more important. In fact, I never learned anything about Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path. But the form was always important. How you sit, how you carry yourself, how you perceive things is much more important in learning the Dhamma. And that's all cultural influences. With no perspective in which to understand the cultural influences, great confusion has arisen. This has led to the original teachings to be shrouded in mystery, hidden behind dogma and ritual, and lacking the context which the original teachings were presented. So again, this is the preface to the book. Understand where I'm coming from. This is to point you in the right direction and point you away from all the fabricated abstractions that have developed into modern Buddhism. The Buddha did not intend his teachings to be useful only for those with the right lineage, the right karma, the right teacher, or the right empowerment, although it was presented that way almost exclusively to me, that you know, whatever is going on, if you don't have these things in place, you're probably not going to go anywhere, especially the right teacher, or the right social position, or the right culture. The Buddha taught a simple and direct path of developing lasting peace and happiness. This teaching is accessible and understandable to anyone who takes to the Dhamma wholeheartedly. I'm going to skip over some of that. This is from the introduction. The Buddha taught four noble truths: the truth of dukkha, or the truth of suffering; the truth of the origination of suffering, which is craving for and clinging to fabricated beliefs; the truth of the cessation of suffering. It's that last noble truth is simply the Buddha's declaration: is yes, you can end your own self-inflicted suffering. That's the truth of it. And the truth of the path, the Eightfold Path, leading to the cessation of suffering. And suffering is, to reiterate, the Buddha's sole purpose for teaching was to bring lasting peace and happiness to all who would wholeheartedly engage with right effort and engage his Dhamma. The Buddha's Dhamma does not include anything that did not directly develop his stated purpose or would likely lead to further confusion. He would not teach anything that further distracted an already confused mind. Again, I can't think of anything more cruel. The Buddha understood that teaching any subject that created further confusion would have been cruel. History has shown the Buddha to be the essence of compassion informed by true wisdom. It takes a lot of strength and courage to do that, to marry your compassion with the wisdom that you develop through the Dhamma. The Buddha always called himself, prior to his awakening, as an unawakened bodhisattva, or bodhisattva is the Sanskrit way of saying that. The bodhisattva ideal has become the goal of most of modern Buddhism. The bodhisattva ideal or position is that I will put aside or delay my own awakening until all sentient beings are awakened. That very vow disavows everything the Buddha taught, which is dukkha occurs. Not every sentient being can ever awaken, according to the Buddha. And the Buddha never saw himself as a savior, and he never tried to teach a salvific religion. He taught an entirely practical way of looking at yourself in relation to the world that brings understanding and a calm and peaceful mind. Nothing religious about it. You can truly say there's nothing spiritual about it. And you can also say, because there's nothing religious or spiritual about it, there's nothing abstract about it. It's to be directly experienced. It's a little bit more on this. Again, from the introduction, in my words. The Buddha consistently refused to answer questions on such subjects as eternalism, infinite versus finite existence, transmigration of a soul, or, by the way, mind-to-mind transmission, which is a big portion of one part of modern Buddhism, or what the self might be, and many more questions that would only cause additional confusion and distract from liberation. Jhana meditation is the method of meditation that the Buddha taught for the 45 years of his teaching the Dhamma. The Buddha never taught any other, you know what, I think I'm going to stop there, because that's about as far as I need to go with the introduction. The Buddha taught meditation within the framework of his Dhamma for a single purpose that becomes obvious once you understand what the Buddha awakened to and what he taught. The Buddha awakened to the fact that it is ignorance of Four Noble Truths that leads to all manner of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking, all manner of confusion, In a word, all manner of dukkha, that's dependent origination, from ignorance through 12 observable causative links, all manner of suffering arises. It's a mind that is rooted in ignorance that is continually distracted from that ignorance. In other words, rooted in that word ignorance is ignore. A mind rooted in ignorance is compelled to ignore its own ignorance so as to continue its ignorance. Does that make sense to everyone? It's rather obvious, isn't it? It's this very powerful and subtle strategies that a mind rooted in ignorance employs to keep that ignorance going. The Buddha recognized this upon his awakening. He saw this clearly. You remember the teachings on the Nagara Sutta, where the Buddha observed this phenomenon within his own mind and being stuck in these fabricated views. And it wasn't until he understood that and extricated himself out of that through jhana meditation and a developing right view of who he was in relation to the world that he was able to stop that process. And that's what he taught. He taught us the same method of stopping that process of continued ignorance and developing wisdom and compassion in a mind that was once rooted in ignorance. The teachings themselves, I believe, are the most brilliant teachings ever given to humanity because of that single point. They actually deliver what he promised. I've been somewhat interested in religion my whole life, born Roman Catholic. I've yet to find any, I've yet to find any religion that actually delivered what it promised. Of course, most religions' promises are only available when you have no way of verifying. And so that was one of my big problems. I wanted to know, I was brought up told that because I was born, I have something called original sin. You know, I'm kind of screwed before I get going. But as long as I do all these things, I might get a break later on. That wasn't good enough for me. I didn't understand why it wasn't good enough for me until much later. But it caused a lot of frustration and a lot of fear. And I think it would to any child that is taught that. It's a cruel teaching. Basically saying that you're worthless here, your worth is somewhere else. It's in another body, in another life, in heaven, if you're lucky enough to get there. In hell, where I thought I was going because of that damn original sin. What a way to live a life. And it wasn't until I actually developed what the Buddha taught, I didn't recognize it at the time, that I was able to develop a calm and peaceful mind because I was able to look at and let go of all of that, I almost said a bad word, all of the fabricated views that, and again, I'm not blaming the world, I'm not blaming society, I'm not blaming my parents, I'm not blaming the priest, I'm not blaming anyone because I'm the one that bought into it. Of course, I was a kid. And it was up to me once I became aware of what was occurring. It is now my responsibility to develop the Dhamma and work my way through it. And I can tell you, and all of you can say, it actually works. That's the point of the Buddha's method, the Buddha's Dhamma. And so that mind rooted in ignorance, prone to distracting itself to continue ignorance, needs a method to calm that, to recognize and calm that distraction. That's why the Buddha taught one meditation method called jhana. He's never taught anything else. Every time the Buddha would instruct those, it's time to go meditate, he'd say, go find the root of a tree or an empty hut and do jhana. And the instructions for jhana are found in the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta. To become mindful of the breath in the body, to become mindful of thoughts, and feelings arising and passing away. Those are the first three foundations, simple. And the fourth foundation of the present quality of your mind. And that's that last instruction that we give in meditation. What the Buddha is teaching, that by first uniting the mind and the body, what we do to initiate every meditation practice, and then be mindful that once your mind is back in your body, you're likely to be distracted by feelings arising and passing away and thoughts arising and passing away. How does he know that? Because he went through it. He understood it in himself. And he understood that a mind that is prone to ignorance uses feelings and thoughts about those feelings to justify its own existence, to establish its existence. How you doing today? That's probably the most common human phrase of ever. How you doing? How you feeling today? How I'm feeling, it doesn't matter. I'm feeling what I'm feeling. My mind resting in what's occurring is simply doing that. It's feeling what it's feeling without the need for that feeling to be any different. And its thoughts are not directed towards or distracted towards what it's feeling. It's simply resting and understanding. This is life as life occurs. And when we can live that way, when we're not grasping after or clinging to feelings and thoughts being a certain way, and maintain, then the quality of our mind is peaceful. If not, the quality of our mind is going to be agitated, either constantly or at times. And that's why that fourth foundation of mindfulness is so important in meditation and off our cushions as a benchmark for how we're doing in Dhamma practice. If we find our minds agitated at times, it simply means we need a bit more jhana practice and we need to integrate more of the Eightfold Path. But that's the purpose of the Dhamma, is to use right meditation, jhana meditation, to increase the refined mindfulness that can hold in mind the Eightfold Path. And as we continue with this study, we're going to learn exactly what Four Noble Truths are, what the Eightfold Path is, how to integrate that. And then as we get deeper into our study, we'll understand in a deep level dependent origination and the formation of anatta, wrong views of self in relation to the world. And finally, we'll conclude our study with a look at hindrances to practices and a few other things. So I think that's a good introduction. What I'd like to hear now is the results of your homework and how you see the preface, the introduction in jhana meditation, what you've learned about it, and how you see it fits into your into the overall Dhamma. And let's start with Dathane. Dathane, how are you today? Oh, wait a minute.
Up here, I'm here.
Ah, good. How are you, Dathane?
I'm good, I'm good. Yeah, great introduction. You know, this week for me has been a real great material for what you're talking about. I mean, I myself, as you know, I'm trying to start my own organization.
Yeah.
And what I find is you know, this idea of clinging to feelings and thoughts, clinging to fabricated views, is really something. Because, you know, I mean, and I only say this just to make a point. You know, here I am, you know, I have two master's degrees, and but yet I'm you know, as I'm trying to build this organization, you know, I have to, you know, work at FedEx so I can, you know, make ends meet and so forth. And so even though me going in, I know that there's something within me that's saying, you know, haven't you gone through, haven't you done enough struggle in school, and haven't you reached a certain level where you don't have to go back to, you know, these quote unquote lower occupations and so forth? That type of feeling was arising in me.
Yeah.
And so for me, I find it to be very powerful how there is, you know, as I you know, especially during this first part where it talks about the truth, cessation, suffering, and the clinging to feelings and thoughts.
Yep.
You know, to say that I'm doing the clinging, because I went into that situation knowing that I'm testing myself. I didn't go into it blind or without any knowledge of that there is some type of bias or prejudice within me. I knew there was. That's why I wanted to go there. But I found it so difficult that there's this other mind, and maybe something that you can talk about, that there's just, it feels like that there's other intentionality. Maybe that's what we'll talk about Mara. There's this other conditioned mind that has its own intentionality that says, you know what, you're not supposed to be here.
Yes.
You know, why are you clinging? Why are you doing this? You know what you are. You know, you need to quit this and so forth. So I find it to be, you know, the practice to be very boots on the ground,
yes.
Dealing with everyday life. And then from there, how do you use skillful practice? How do you use jhana when, you know, your coworker next to you is getting on your nerves and so forth? How do you use it then?
Yeah.
And I find it to be very helpful, you know, going back to the breath and getting habitually the meditation practice of going back to the breath and feeling these feelings without being entangled by them. You know, I can feel, I can not, and this is not necessarily abstractly think, I can feel what it means to be liberated from it.
Okay.
Even though I'm still uncomfortable in that situation, yet I'm not like before entangled by it. So I don't know if you want to talk about something of that nature or what's your comment on that.
Yes. thank you, Dathane. You're describing, I mean, it's something we talk about all the time here. You're describing yourself applying the Dhamma at the point of contact. And think about it this way, Dathane. If you didn't know anything about the Dhamma, you wouldn't be thinking about where your eye-making is coming into play here, where your self-referential views are causing distress. It would simply be a matter of justifying the feeling rather than understanding it's coming from within you, like the Salatha Sutta says. You are, and we all are, learning to take responsibility for how we feel and how we think rather than put it on external conditions. And there's nothing personal about what you're doing. And it's just what is occurring. But we tend to see things from that self-referential point of view. Using your words, I have two master's degrees. This is not something I should be doing. Well, the truth is, there you are doing it. You know, it's your human life that is occurring right now. It's not your human life in relation to an ideal. It's simply what's going on. But it's the ideological view that we create about ourselves that then creates that underlying tension, the fabricated view, that I should be or things should be something different than what's occurring when they can't be, can they? This is simply what's occurring in your life. Why not be at peace with it? But again, your thought process that you're describing is Dhamma practice, recognizing that this is what's occurring. How do I minimize the I-making in this? You take a breath, you unite your mind and your body. In the moment of stress, as stress is arising, we can always remind ourselves to take a breath, bring my mind back in my body, remind ourselves that the impersonal nature of life, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am. And even then, you might not have a calm and peaceful mind. So what do? You learn the fourth foundation of mindfulness, that in this moment, I am going to be at peace with a less than peaceful mind. That's what the Buddha is teaching in that fourth foundation of mindfulness. Excuse me. He's not teaching a fabricated way of establishing a trance-like blissful state no matter what's occurring. He's teaching us how to be down and dirty with life as life occurs and yet remain calm and peaceful no matter what is occurring. And it's out of understanding. So when stress arises or a stressful situation arises, because as the Buddha teaches, I understand the nature of stress, I don't have to react to it. But in the moment, I might actually be experiencing a less than peaceful mind. Does that help with your, or is that an adequate answer, Dathane?
Yeah, that was very good, especially that last part, being at peace with a less than peaceful mind. That you hit the nail right on the head. I've read that in different sutras. The one that comes to mind is the eight winds. Yeah. That really kind of nails that down. That's something that's really it's a wonderful teaching, and it's a very bitter pill to swallow. That really, and it's a very mature way to practice.
Yeah, well.
So you're right. Being at peace with a less than peaceful mind is what it's, you know, is what it's all about. And it's interesting because I think we talked about it before. When you there's a way of being at peace with, you know, not having your toy being taken from you. But now it's like, well, what why is that such a big thing? And so I think for me, I think this requires a great way, a journey towards a really mature practice. So yeah, thank you very much for that.
Thank you for saying that, Dathane. The best description I can give of an awakened human being is fully mature, because that's what it is. That's what the Buddha is teaching us. You think about a fully mature person, maturity meaning you have complete understanding of who you are in relation to the world. That maturity would no longer get upset at things changing all the time, would it? Mm-hmm. Or she, excuse me. Because you understand it. It's not rooted, again, in a fabrication. You understand the nature of stress and suffering as a consequence of having a human life. When the Buddha described dukkha, he didn't describe it in any esoteric or mystical way, entirely practical way. Birth is suffering, meaning as a consequence of being born a human being, there's going to be suffering. And then he says along the way, there's going to be sickness and aging. That's going to be stressful too. And he said, by the way, at the end of all of this, you get to die. That's stressful. And then he says, along that way, you're going to get things you don't want, stressful. And you're going to lose things that you do want, stressful. And then he would conclude this statement, this profound statement that nobody wants to face except us, with, in short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful. The five clinging aggregates are the Buddha's description of the personal experience of ongoing ignorance. The five clinging aggregates. Ongoing ignorance is stressful. So the solution to ongoing ignorance being stressful is understanding where there was once ignorance. Why the Buddha's Dhamma works. Thank you, Dathane. Thad, how are you? Good to see you this morning.
Oh, thank you, John. Yeah, the lot of things, a lot of good things here. The Samsapa Sutta, I like that because it seems like in my a lot of my practice. Before I attended some of the same places I think that you did, the goal of a lot of that practice was to understand those leaves in the tree.
Yep.
The idea was if you could get some sort of knowledge of the meaning of the universe and awaken to it, then you would be qualified to begin Dhamma practice.
Yep.
And then it worked. You sort of never got there, or at least I did, you know, the way I understood it. I'm going to bring this thing, though, this introduction down to real personal level here as far as Dhamma practice, though. This is just some notes I jotted down that the analogy of training the mind that the Buddha uses of the elephant and the rope and the stake is very, very helpful to me because what happens a lot of times, when I'm trying to meditate, monkey mind is just taken over, and there's sort of, along with that, it's like I'm almost a reporter reporting on the condition of how am I doing in my Dhamma practice. If I can remember the Buddha's instructions, there is that mindfulness of the breath and the breath being that stake and the mindfulness of the breath being that rope that keeps me attached there. That's I'd heard that analogy before, and it was just a kind of an interesting, colorful saying. But now it actually is an instruction for Dhamma practice, and it really helps me come back to what I'm supposed to be doing in the moment.
Yeah.
And one other thing that I've jotted down for myself is also had set this goal of having maybe a 30 to 35 minute session in the morning and one in the evening, and that would be my commitment to it. And what I found out was in the morning, I'm still working. And in the morning, a lot of times I'd be end up sitting there making excuses why I can't really sit 35 minutes. And that would lead me to either not practice that morning or something. So I've shortened my sessions a little bit per your recommendation. I've shortened some of my session in the morning a little bit to about 20 minutes. And that way I don't have any excuse for that restless mind hindrance taking over. Yeah. So a lot of good stuff here. Thank you very much for teaching.
Thank you, Thad. And that last little bit, it's a self-referential ego-based mind that wants to, I can meditate for 40 minutes or an hour. And if I can't do the whole thing, then I'm not doing it right. The reasonable thing is just cut back a little bit. You know, 20 minutes is a fine practice. Good for you. Thank you, Thad. Let me go on to Michael. Michael, how are you? Well, does everybody know what Thad was referring to? The how to train a wild elephant?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. It's such an important little part of that sutta, though. Michael, good morning.
Hi, John. How are you? I'm here with Julia.
Hi, Julia.
Hi, John.
How are you?
Hi, John.
Hi, good, everybody.
Good. Hi, Dad.
we had to go to New York to do some family things, so that's why we're not there. We're not just too lazy to make our way down there.
Oh, I thought it was the latter, Wes.
It is a priority to be there, as you know.
I'm glad you joined us online.
I'm kind of all over the place with my notes and everything. You can see I've got my book here and I'm reading. And I just want to say, you know, Julia and I started reading this book. We love this book, John. And it's so nicely written. It's just from reading, the preface, introduction, and this first chapter, it's just like kind of has deepened our understanding of just like a lot of the core concepts that you bring up in class all the time. So I'm just very happy that we went from the structured study into this book. And David had mentioned that this would be this is a nice read, and he said that, you know, we would like it, and we hit the nail right on the head, because we sure do. Not to take too much time here. So we're doing well with this, and our Dhamma practice is doing well. We recognize and we restrain, and we employ the Eightfold Path, so that's the whole nature of the thing. I just like to bring up like one thing you had said, I like this because, again, it's a good concept when you brought up the nature of ignorance, and you know, like ignoring one's own ignorance, I think that's very important. It's very easy to, point out, hey, look at the way that person is acting, how ignorant they are, At the same time, we're ignorant to the fact that you know, that's ignorant in itself, you know what I mean? So we have to like turn that that focus on us and be introspective and come up, you know, the right action and right thought and right view and right speech and everything that we do and so on and so forth. So I just wanted to bring that up. It was, again, it was a moment for me to say, you know, step back and just think a little bit more about the Dhamma and what it truly means. So thank you for everything, John. Wow. Once again, thank you so much.
Thank you for joining. Julie, what do you have to say? You don't have to say anything.
she's camera shy. That's what
I am.
Oh, so am I. Well, I'm just glad you both could join us today. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
Yeah, thank you.
Jen.
Hello. Okay, I didn't do my homework. I apologize.
What would you do if your students told you that?
I'd be like, okay. I can take that personally. Yeah, 140 kids just don't have that kind of time.
Oh,
but I'm just sitting and listening today and thinking about how, you know, the nature of being a human being is to experience sensations arising and passing away within us, and then to watch how the mind reacts to those sensations,
yeah,
and what the mind adds to those sensations,
yeah,
and how the mind judges and interprets them, and that is eye making. And when you add to what's just occurring, when your mind adds to what is just occurring in this moment, a reaction or a resistance or an aversion, then you suffer.
Yep.
And so remind yourself, if you catch yourself doing that, well, first you need concentration to catch yourself. But then once you do, just remember, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. Whether it's, I don't like this feeling, I don't like what I'm doing, this should be different than it is, what am I doing here? Any question, reaction, judgment of what's happening right now is just resisting what's happening right now.
That's right.
And distracting from what's happening right now,
yeah,
which is ignorance.
Yeah.
That's what I thought about.
That's a complete Dhamma, what you just described. And in that moment, whatever is causing a disturbance in your mind, whether it's wanting more or wanting less of what's occurring, or the more common experience is just being completely ambiguous, meaning nothing's going on, you've lost your life, haven't you? Because you're not in it. You're not living it. That's why the Buddha refers to the living in ignorance as like a death state. And he calls an awakened state as the deathless state, meaning you're free of ignorance. So.
Oh, there's one more thing. I did think to myself, wow, I really wish I did my homework, but then I realized, this is not me, this is not mine.
I guess you can use the Dhamma.
The jury's out.
Oh, that's really you.
What I would say is that person that's not you should do their homework.
Not skillfully, yeah.
Thank you, Jen. Good morning, Rhonda. The thing,
John?
Yes, sir.
Could you just say that one more time about the deathless and the death state? I think it's a very important point. I didn't catch it. I wanted to write.
Yeah, the Buddha always, and this goes to, there's some teachings that teach that the Buddha somehow teaches eternality, and somehow you could live forever. I never could quite get that. But when the Buddha was referring to the deathless state, he was referring to the state of mind free of ignorance. And he always referred to living with ignorance as like a living death. So liberation from ignorance is finally coming alive. And that is the best description of living in ignorance I can think of. Because when we're in ignorance, we're not living what's occurring. We're living a fabricated view in relation to what's occurring. And we're actually, how do I say it? You could say you're one step or one thought, one clear thought removed from reality of what's occurring. You're not living your life. So thank you for bringing that up to think. It's an important point.
Good morning. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Lonnie.
Good morning. I seem to be on the same theme as a lot of other practitioners this morning.
Good.
And I could give you one perfectly good example is that when, usually when we get the newsletter and we learn about what you're going to teach, the next class, read it. And usually I get inspired, and you can have like an aha moment, or the bell goes off and you just see something in the Dharma that you haven't seen. And it's kind of like inspiring and gratifying and uplifting and all that sort of stuff. So usually when I prepare for a class, I enjoy the reading. However, there was a lot of the beginning of the book here that actually I know very well, and it's not, it wasn't inspiring, it wasn't uplifting, it wasn't...
You don't need to be so honest.
There was no bells going off or light bulbs going off. It was just like, I was just reading it. To the point I was bored, but I did recognize that I have a, you know, that's a thought and a feeling.
So...
It's just another example of what Nathane says. Jen says that it's just another practical description of what everybody's talking about.
Yeah.
It was just because usually I'm inspired to read it.
Yeah.
And this time I was kind of like let down a bit because I kind of know it, you know, I know your history and all that sort of stuff. Describing how to sit in a meditation, I find boring and...
You're the one that said we should do this.
I wasn't going to do the truth of happiness course. I was just like plodding through it, you know, and that was the thought, the feeling, and all the, and I was like.
You were talking about redundancy because you've done this before.
Yeah. And it was kind of like, that's the Dharma.
Yeah, it is.
That's what it is. And it's a thought and a feeling, and I felt, and that's how I felt reading this bit. I'm sure when we get onto the Eightfold Path and things, it'll be different, but that's how I felt.
Thank you. Again, and that's, the Dhamma is like that too, isn't it? Sometimes it's inspiring and exciting, and sometimes it's new.
Yeah.
Do I really want to do that? Yeah. And that's why there's the six factors of the Eightfold Path is right effort. It's a reminder. Keep going. It doesn't matter how you're feeling or how you're thinking. If you're bored right now, take a breath, come back in your body, and come to class. So thank you. And that's just what you did. Morning, Ram.
Good morning, Jeff. I actually did do my homework.
Okay.
and I did a pretty very careful read through of those chapters. And I do find that compared to previous years, I have a better understanding of jhana. And as I was reading through, so I was kind of checking things off. Okay. Got that one. This, you know, I'm still living with a very high level of distraction in my meditation. And but I'm realizing that in previous years, I've been trying to get rid of these thoughts. You know? And again, reading through it again. And practicing more in the last say, year or two, the thoughts are going to be there, one way or the other,
yeah.
And so I just need to deal with the actual distraction of them. And I'm realizing that. I just have a high level of distraction. This is my current state of mind.
Yeah.
Period. And that's now finally starting to creep into to my practice, my meditation practice, that I'm realizing this is my state of mind. And I can be upset about it. I can be bored. I can be whatever I want to be, but it's still my state of mind. So I better be at peace with that. And that's been the big thing in the last few months of just realizing that the state of distraction is there.
Thank you. That's such an important point. Many people think that the ultimate goal of meditation is to develop a trance-like state where you're. And I could teach all of you in about 3 minutes. I could put you all in a trance-like state. I don't, because again, it's a cruel thing to do. If you're in a trance-like state, there's no opportunity for insight into what's occurring, is there? You've just created another barrier in yourself to recognizing and abandoning ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The Buddha, again, there were meditation methods that did that. Any meditation today, like a visualization, that even though it's called meditation, it's not, is a way of distracting yourself from what's really occurring. The Buddha taught a way to unite a mind and its body so that it can observe what's going on within that mind and body. There's no other way to liberate yourself, would there be? I mean, but that thinking that directed Siddhartha Gautama to that way of understanding is just brilliant. But it's obvious, too. In order to change your mind, you have to be in your mind and be familiar with your mind, what's occurring. But we can't do that if our minds are always distracted. And you have just described again how to develop a Dhamma practice. You keep going, you start recognizing, because of the framework you develop, where you need to apply the Dhamma and where you just go on with your life.
Yeah. And see, the other factors come along just fine. And you know, right effort is worth it.
Yeah.
But that's the beginning.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's Dhamma practice. So again, that's what we're all describing. It's remarkable. Good morning, Tim.
Well, morning, because it's neither good nor bad. Just want to point that out. And to everybody online, Michael, Julia, Thad, Nathane, everybody here. So what I did was I prioritized the when I did the readings, when I read the chapter. So bear with me, if I could, just briefly. So one thing... the first thing that really came out at me was the dispassion and disenchantment towards the feelings, thoughts, and emotions and all external phenomena during meditation.
Yep.
Dispassion of it. And that's something I think, well, I was talking about, and I'm talking about it last week, when the stuff comes up, to be mindful of that and be dispassionate about it. And that's something that really struck out. And then I realized when I was reading as well that I'm reading from my notes that I have in caps ego. All self-referential views, conditioned mind needs to cling into grasp, needs to crave what pleasures it wants, and aversion to unpleasantries, time traveling to the future, worry and doubt, and the past, regret, anger, and sadness. At the present point of contact, ego is fed with these wrong views that leads to the next rebirth. And that's right out of dependent origination. And so those thought processes during meditation pop in, and in that moment that comes in, that is established, that wrong view. And then the thing that really, again, this has kind of ties it together, is that the right mindfulness, again, this is from what I got out of the chapter, right mindfulness can only be achieved with concentration and dispassion.
Yep.
No judgment, no over-analytical to the arising phenomena. Acceptance of the present moment, each moment. And once this concentration is developed, one can be mindful of the breath, feelings arising, thoughts arising, and the present quality of mind without any judgment, with dispassion.
Yeah.
I'm going fast because I want everybody to get a turn. I don't like to talk fast, but I'm doing it anyway. And the thing that I wrote for where I would need to improve in my jhana meditation is to avoid being overly analytical and harsh with my practice.
Yeah.
Number two is to focus on the mindfulness and the in-breath and out-breath. And the other thing is that this is a marathon and not a sprint. To enjoy the journey, to be mindful of the improving mindfulness, if that makes any sense.
Yeah,
and
makes a lot of sense.
And step backwards without being judgmental, and again, being dispassionate when these things come up. And I took these notes without going back, so I just keep seeing dispassionate coming up all the time. So that's the essence of what I've got out of this. But two other little sidebars. One thing that you said, and this is something that I'm noticing with myself, and something you said in the chapter, I want to just read it real quick. It's a quick paragraph. It is important to note here the significant difference between a thought that directs a proper and appropriate thoughts and behavior and a thought that develops additional stress and distraction. And I don't want to go through what you mean by that. I think you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know,
it's just brilliant.
That is something that I find myself doing. I'm at the point now where I already have said something that's within the Dhamma inappropriate, but it's already too late. But I'm not judging myself and being harsh on myself with it.
Mm-hmm.
Just realizing I said it, just have better effort next time and avoid restraint, or have restraint and not doing it again. And then I wanted to ask you, and I think I wanted to talk to the Sangha about this. When we refer to ignorance, we're referring to the ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, not ignorance of not knowing something in the worldly phenomena.
Yeah.
And within the Dhamma, when we talk about rebirth or death or karma, we're talking about that end result of dependent origination each moment.
Yep, what you're giving birth to in this moment.
And I think that was something that took me a while to really, I think a lot of newcomers, including myself, didn't understand that. Mm. And I think it should be stressed more that when we're talking about ignorance, we're not talking about being stupid. We're talking about being ignorant of the Four Noble Truths that caused this. And so that's what I got out of this wonderful chapter.
Yeah, thank you. You get a gold star for your homework.
I get minus.
thank you. Yeah, and that's an important point that I think we emphasize often. It's not to, as human beings, we're ignorant of certain things. That's irrelevant. It doesn't matter what we're ignorant of. The only thing that matters within the Dhamma is to recognize that we're ignorant of these four basic human truths called noble truths. That's the Dhamma, is developing that understanding. And admitting that we're ignorant of something that we've never been taught shouldn't be all that difficult, although it is for a self-referential ego personality. It does never wants to admit that it's wrong or doesn't know something, but that's the challenge of conditioned mind. Thank you. Marcine, you don't have to say anything. You're welcome to just pass. Welcome to our Sangha. And do you have anything you'd like to say or any questions?
Well, I didn't do my homework. So
well, you didn't have any homework yet. So. You will today.
I'm listening to all of these comments and homework, and I feel like I don't know what's the word, and pardon my accent. I feel like I've been in some of the situations, mm-hmm. and the first gentleman was talking about the stress and, you know, trying to do something that he doesn't feel like he should be doing. I'm on the same kind of page, you know. I feel like I'm kind of programmed to do stuff rather than kind of doing what I love to do. And, you know, this is the reason I started to meditate a couple of months ago. It's interesting to hear all these, you know, experiences and stuff, and I feel I'm in the right place to improve, you know, on that.
Yeah, we're all happy to hear you say that. Thank you again. Welcome to our Sangha. You speak very good English.
No, thank you.
I ain't no good at English. the meditation that we did, that you able to do that without any difficulty, you understand it?
And I can actually quickly say why, you know, being into martial arts most of my life, I feel like the focus and stuff, it's not a problem for me. I've gotten sick about 3 years ago, and I have huge hissing in my ear. So when I started meditating, for the first month, I said to myself, I can't do it. Yeah. It's just like, oh my gosh, it's hissing. I'm like, oh my God. So, and there was this, about a month and a half later, I went out on a session, and I thought it was 15 minutes. I woke up in like an hour and 30 minutes. I'm like, hold on, what just happened? The hissing went away. I'm sitting here, so I'm awake. I didn't pass out, right? I'm like, oh, okay, that's doable. So I kind of got this under control and started to being really interested into, you know, improving this stuff. You know? So yeah, that was pretty, you know, pretty good, you know, meditation this morning. Yeah.
And you're able to maintain the method?
Yeah.
You find yourself caught up in your thoughts, come back to your breath. That's the basic meditation.
I find this fairly, the monkey thing, you know, it was happening to me on the beginning. It was really tough, you know. Yeah. I keep coming like, why are you thinking about work? Why, hold on. And I feel like the breathing for me is the most important thing. Every time I just go away, I feel like I'm breathing into my head, actually. And it's just, everything's gone.
You're doing it as it's intended. Have you been to my website, becoming-buddha.com?
No, I was trying to stop by for a month, but there's always something. I have 14-year-old actually, and there's just always something. I'm like, oh my gosh, this Saturday, no, this Tuesday, no. I'm like, I haven't even had
that. Well, when you get a chance, there's guided jhana meditations. Just like we did here, that you can download and listen to from 5 to 45 minutes. And then on the home page, there's a welcome section. If you read that, it'll direct you towards where to begin your study. If you ever have any questions, just send me an email, and I hope you continue. We're in the middle of this, the beginning of this study. And this book, again, I have it here. It's on Amazon, but it's also on the website, so you can just follow along. So what we're going to do now this next week is read the second chapter, and then you're going to write a paragraph or two and bring it here like everyone has done this morning, and we'll talk about that next week. In the same class, this class will be taught again on Tuesday, and then next Saturday we'll discuss the second chapter, and next Tuesday the second chapter. So, again, welcome to our Sangha. Barbara, good to see you.
So I'm new to the study of Buddhism, and I've been in a state of confusion, but I've been meditating, I've been doing the reading, and I had a little bit of an epiphany this week in that I've decided, you know, like we exercise to strengthen our muscles and our cardiovascular system because it makes it easier for us to do physical things in our life.
Yeah.
And I'm finding that meditation is helping me strengthen my mind to deal better with emotional things. So, and I was able to apply that this week because it was unusual. I had 5 things on my calendar. They all got canceled. I had nothing to do with the cancellations. And I was able to manage that gracefully.
Yeah. Isn't that remarkable? I mean, that's the Dhamma at work, maintaining a calm and peaceful mind no matter what occurs. That's it. And you're understanding that the other teachings support meditation, and meditation supports integrating the rest of the Dhamma. That's what it is. That's what we do here. So I'm glad you're getting the benefit of it today. Kevin, good to see you.
Good to see you, Dan. Everybody's comments are so amazing.
Yeah.
You've been great. I like starting this again. I like that there are new people in the group, and I would recommend that you know, it's a great way, it's a great entree into Buddhism and the Dhamma.
Uh-huh.
It's where I started with this when I was, you know, just a few weeks into my own meditation at home, and then trying to figure out how am I going to integrate this. And then John and got to obtain the book and then went through it, even through it a couple more times. Yeah. We've been through so much in the past few years and so many suttas and so much teaching that it's really good just to start again and see how it's all integrated. Yeah. It's wonderful.
Thank you. It really is. I'm reconstructing the website, meaning I'm going back into every page, and I don't mean this to sound self-aggrandizing. It is remarkable the depth and breadth of Dhamma that's been presented here at Cross River Meditation Center. You know, just, I don't know that there's anything. Again, I hope it doesn't sound too self-aggrandizing. I haven't come across anything that presents the Buddha's Dhamma in this way and as complete as it is. It's just, and that we're all integrating it. I mean, nobody's coming here to hang out. You know, we're engaged in right effort in a very gentle but direct way. It's remarkable, and we've been doing it a while, huh?
Yeah.
How long has it been? When did you start?
3 years. Good 3 years.
Yeah, one or about four. Ram from the beginning. Yeah. It's amazing. Becky, good to see you today.
Good to be here. Very good to be here. I'm happy that we're doing this again. I did not do my homework. But I feel like the last 26 sessions that we did.
The structure study? 33 or 34.
32. I feel like those were so intense, and that I really learned a lot and learned really the essence of what the Dhamma is. Yeah. But now to go to do this again, I feel like it's going to really be mine after this. I'm going to internalize it. It's going to be so good to just revisit the truth of happiness and realize what it was like when I went through it the first time versus this time. And I know in order to experience that, I will have to do my homework.
Yes.
No. But secondly, I'm really with Ron, with the monkey mind and the meditation. I meditate and I'm like, wow. I always listen to your tape when I meditate. So I have your callbacks.
Good.
So the callback happens. I'm like, wow, where have I been? I've definitely not been here. And that happens so often. And I was getting really discouraged by that. And now I just realize that I would just keep doing it. And when I'm able to come back to my breath, when I'm able to think of coming back to my breath, I will come back to my breath, and that's all I can do. That's all I can do until, you know, I know eventually that more and more wisdom will come, and I will be able to get more insight into what's happening in my life.
Thank you, Becky.
I find it creeping into your life more than your, at least that's
yes,
what I feel.
Yes.
It's more in my daily practice, my out in the world practice, that I see the progress. You know.
Well, yeah, that
the meditation is what it is right now. So.
For almost everyone I've ever taught, it is in the moment that we practice the Dhamma, and it's in the moment that we realize it's working. Just like you described, but you said something that is so profound, and it relates to this deathless state that you weren't even in. You didn't had no idea where you were when you came. What think of that?
Mm-hmm.
You're actually having a life. You're in your body, and you have no idea where you are. That's the essence of ignorance, isn't it?
Yes.
Isn't it? And, but we, as human beings, rooted in ignorance, live our whole lives in that state of mind, not knowing where we are. And then we wonder why we're stressed out.
And that's when we're working on it. So what we're like when we're not even conscious that we're working on it.
Yeah. Right. But again, so rooted in endless fabrications, and each fabrication takes us further away from reality, meaning what's occurring in this moment. Reality isn't hard to understand or be in. It's much more difficult to maintain a fabricated life, yet most of us do it. Again, there's that word stress again. And the Buddha teaches a simple and direct way that is so effective in uniting a mind and its body and keeping it there and developing a life of lasting peace and happiness. Hence the name of the book, The Truth of Happiness. Jen, did you have a question?
Yeah, I just had something that was like that I wanted to kind of point out, and maybe this is unnecessary, but something that Ram said and that Mom said when you guys were both talking about monkey mind and how you're reacting to your own monkey mind.
Mm-hmm.
That I wanted to like point out in terms of orienting yourself in meditation or even off the cushion, is the reaction when you start to, why am I thinking about all this? Or if you can catch yourself doing that, that's something that if you can see that reaction, rather than orienting yourself to the thoughts, orient yourself to the reaction and say, that is anatta.
Yeah.
And that, if when it happens moment to moment, if you can see that and say, this is not me. And just create this a little bit of space there between what's happening right now, which is I'm thinking a lot and I'm reacting to thinking a lot.
Yeah.
You can see that. I feel like that is an application.
That's a perfect application.
I don't know. Maybe I didn't need to.
No, that's Dhamma at the point of contact, and that's why you're going to make a great teacher.
Oh, thank you.
As Liz always
two
says,
of our four
this is not to me.
Yeah.
Can I add on to what Jen said?
No, please. Of course.
So, to what Jen... I'm Italian, so this. I love that. This is not to me.
Yeah.
Sorry,
Tim. No, that's okay. To what Jen was saying, and Ram, and Becky. So that's the foundations of mindfulness, right? The being mindful of the breath, obviously, but then also the arising feelings and the thoughts arising, and then the quality of mind. And then being dispassionate about it and forgetting where we are is that's dependent origination at working.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. But as we, and that's, I know it's simple, but it's, it is not for, you have said this, not for the faint of heart, because it takes a lot of perseverance and practice.
Oh, boy, that's for sure.
It really does. And that's where the judgment comes in.
Mm-hmm. Self-judgment.
The self-judgment.
Yeah.
So when I'm on my cushion, same way, I'm really just noticing at that point of contact that quality of mind.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you for bringing it back.
And I think that's what you were referring to. The
fourth foundation of mindfulness. Mm-hmm. So. It's wonderful. Boy, what a great teaching you all gave today. Really, it was remarkable. Matt and I were talking about this, coming through this Vipassana structured study, the 35-week thing. It's just amazing how this whole Sangha developed, that true Vipassana, true introspective insight into the three marks of existence. And it, I can see that it's all, I know you're just catching up now, Marcin, but you will. How much it's in Barbara too, it's impacted your life, is understanding just that one thing. Where are we putting our focus for insight? What's it to? It's not to every common occurrence. It's to the nature of anatta in relation to the world that living in, the nature of wrong views of self, creating stress in its own environment. And as we discussed here, recognizing and abandoning our own cause, our own contributions to that stress, and simply letting it go. Remarkable. So this week, we read chapter 2. We'll all do a little bit of writing on it, and we'll come back next Tuesday, next Saturday, and with our homework. we'll continue it that way. I was thinking the same thing, Becky, that going through this now as a Sangha is going to be a very profound experience for everyone. And I wasn't even going to do it this year. But Lorna and Ram and David said, you better do it, or they're leaving the Sangha. So we're doing it. And thank you all for joining online. We'll finish as we always do with the Karaniya Metta Sutta. So again, take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. Unite your mind back in your body. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another. Excuse me. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.